Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're here to discuss the offense from that Bills game. A much happier discussion than we had talking about the defense yesterday. Here to do that with me today is Jonas Schaefer of the Baltimore Banner. Jonas, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken. Great to kick off these season openers with you.
Yeah, lots of fun. I always appreciate having you on whenever we can get you. If we get you early, maybe we can get you again late, but you know how it goes. It's great to talk football. Obviously, a huge loss for a number of reasons for the Ravens. It has postseason seeding implications. But I did want to ask you the question. Do you think that any flaws that are not fixable were really exposed in this game?
I guess it depends on what you define as flaw. Like, they're not going to be, barring a return to the field for Emory Jones, they're not going to be super athletic at guard. You know, they might not have an A- to A+ pass rusher all year, and they'll have to get by with a lot of guys who are average to above average. You're going to have to live with the ups and downs of a rookie kicker. But I think for the most part, they have a lot fewer flaws. If you know, whatever your definition of a flaw is, than, you know, 30 other teams in the NFL, 31 other teams in the NFL. So, you know, I'm wary of overreacting to one week to such a small sample size, but I think for the most part, the few flaws that they do have are relatively small, and I think coverable by either the fact that they have Lamar Jackson or the fact that they have what we think is a good, smart, adaptable coaching staff.
Yeah. Those are first world problems, I think, right? what you just described in terms of things. A dominant offensive effort. They fell short in quarter four. It's very difficult to find things that were distinctly wrong with this offense in this game when the overall level was so high. But I go back to something that Monken said to us in camp, was that they wanted to practice intentionally and they wanted to split out the things they didn't do well from the things they did do well in what was overall an outstanding offensive performance in 2024 in terms of what they were practicing for. And I think that goes well for this game. There's a lot of things still on the offense that could use a little fixing. You know, being without a tight end, being without Isaiah Likely, it hurt the team offensively in terms of what they could do in this game. They don't look like the sort of drive-sustaining team that the 2019 team was by any stretch. Just the ability with a more dominant offensive line to run the football effectively and sustain 10 and 12 play drives. I mean, they went the whole second half, and they didn't have a drive over four plays in this game.
Yeah, I guess I would push back slightly on the two tight end stuff, because, again, this was from Nate Tice at 10:51, so maybe this changed later on that night, but they ran 14 plays. The first 14 plays out of 12 personnel, results were 199 yards, 14.2 yards per play, 73% success rate, one touchdown. And obviously,
that's fantastic.
That was with Mitchell Payton, I think, being a lead blocker on a couple big Derrick Henry home runs. But obviously, you know, there were limitations, and there were definitely some throttling of the targets for the tight ends without Mark too involved, and with no Isaiah Likely to get passes to. Obviously Charlie Kohler, I don't think, got a single target. So
zero for anyone else.
Yeah, it was definitely different. And I guess we'll kind of see. It's also a little bit too early for me to see this offense. How do I say it? I don't know for sure that I can call it about this offense being not able to grind out drives. I think just the way that Buffalo played, the very shoddy play of their safeties, lent itself to the Ravens just knocking off explosives that hastened their way to the end zone. Mm-hmm. And it's possible that if, you know, Cole Bishop was more competent and Taylor Rapp were more competent, the Ravens still would have scored on those drives. It just would have been, you know, over the course of a 10 to 12 play drive, as opposed to a 4 or 7 play drive.
Yeah. I guess the one number, and it's not a kind of sample size that bothers me by any stretch yet. Okay. I think they did miss Patrick Ricard in the game, but the number that bothers me is that Derrick Henry had a 44% success rate in a game where he just ran all over the Bills. So it wasn't a matter of he didn't run for enough yards per carry. He ran for, you know, almost 9 yards a carry. Maybe it was even more than that. But whatever it was, he didn't have a real high success rate. It was a bunch of home runs and a bunch of losses. And
yeah. And that was like a weird, not stat, but that was like a weird byproduct of some of his biggest games last year. You know, they would go into a game, for instance, against the Cincinnati Bengals, who, you know, I'd written about and had talked at length about in the days leading up to it, about how this is the team with not just the worst run defense by success rate in the NFL, but like one of the worst the past history, 5 years. Yeah. And then they go into that game in Baltimore in prime time. And, you know, sure, Cincinnati's loading the box, as you do to stop a team with Lamar Jackson, Derrick Henry, but they just could not get anything going. And there were, you know, that wasn't obviously the big Derrick Henry versus Cincinnati game. The big one was the one on the road. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there are still those weird games where he might end up with 120 yards or 150 yards. But as you said, the success rate is not all the way there, because either Lamar's not getting them to the right play, or Todd Monken isn't doing the right scheming, or, you know, more likely just they're not winning the way that you would like them to win up front for Derrick Henry to turn those 3 yard runs into 5 yard runs, and thus, you know, stay quote unquote ahead of the chains.
It was a very similar game to the past for Henry, in that they were using him to run the clock out. And they've done that with Henry before, in terms of having him be a closer, and that didn't really negatively impact his success rate last year. And that's I guess where a lot of my you know, problems with the thing come up. Perfect weather situation. I mean, all offensive options are open. It wasn't a case of anything with that was holding him back. So I hope we don't see a run game that has a lot more variance to it this year than it has for the Ravens in the past. The hallmark of all the Jackson teams has been success rate in the run game. That's the most consistent element of the Jackson offenses.
Yeah, and I think they added some new wrinkles to the run game. There was a play, I think it was maybe only a 4 or 5 yard run, but it's like it's Fialele kind of looping underneath Linderbaum to the weak side of the play, while Linderbaum goes the play side, I guess looking to maybe stagger the linebackers in their flow and maybe create a gap. It didn't really look like it hit that successfully, but it was definitely strange and interesting to see, because initially when you watch it, you're like, is Daniel Fialele going the right way? And then based on how everyone else is moving and the fact that Linderbaum, you know, was on the right track, so to speak, it seemed like that wasn't the intention all along.
So we scored the offensive line today, and one of the things that Maureen twice pointed out is, did so-and-so pull on that play? And I think one of them was Fialele, and it looked like Linderbaum went to level two on one play, and almost they're trying to get away from some of Fialele's weaknesses as a in terms of flow, to go towards the defense where the defense is flowing and pick up a block that way.
Right. And remember, this is what I brought up with you the last time I potted with you, just you know, the value of Falele last year was that he was a good pass blocker, but just imagine how much fun this run game could be if he were lighter, which he has been, if he were a better run blocker, because when the Ravens did run outside zone and stretch plays last year, you know, according to the Sports Info Solutions data that I looked at, they were frighteningly awesome, but they just obviously felt constrained perhaps in some ways by getting an elephant that big on the move. So they have dialed it back. They obviously, I think I had a pretty good variety of zone versus gap schemes yesterday, excuse me, on Sunday. So we'll see just how that kind of trends and what it means for the rest of the year in terms of, you know, that balance of the different philosophies for the run game.
We'll get into the offensive line scoring in the second half of the show, but I did want to say this: a massive day for Lamar Jackson, a big night for Henry Jackson, for Henry rather, except for the fumble, and yet a really, from my way of seeing it, a very subpar performance by the offensive line going across. And Stanley was the only player who really stood out. Linderbaum was okay. And everybody else was below okay. Put it that way. We'll get into it a little later. Tough night for Daniel Falele. That clip was very bad of what he did. It was hardly his worst play of the night. So unfortunately, kind of a regression from Daniel from how he finished up last season.
Yeah, I think having just watched the tape, obviously you have your own, you know, this whole thing is just kind of calling balls and strikes, and we each have our own idea of the strike zone. I think that I thought a little more highly of them than you did. Again, you know, not that this is the end all be all, but I think PFF had them, you know, as an objective arbiter of these kind of performances. I think had them as like the 15th best offensive pass blocking, which again includes tight ends, fullbacks, even wide receivers if they're used for week one. I think they had them as the number one run blocker, which obviously I'm sure was helped by guys like Rashad Bateman, Mark Andrews doing work in the open field. And then I think ESPN put up their pass rush win rates for the first week. And again, that's basically, are you winning your block within the first 2.5 seconds, especially in pass blocking. And those guys had the Ravens fourth in pass blocking with a 79% win rate, and then 15th in run blocking. So it was interesting to see that kind of inversion of the PFF grades. And I think Lamar in some cases maybe did the offensive line no favors just with his drops or with how long he held onto the ball, but obviously you more than likely will take the risk reward proposition because it's Lamar and because we've seen him do that incredible stuff over and over again.
We have seen that, and honestly, Lamar didn't take advantage of extended plays in this game. 2.7 average time per throw is very, very low for him. I mean, it's probably half a second below average. Yeah, it's probably a little bit less than half a second below average. He's about 3.1, 3.15 right, maybe last year. And 2.7, I mean, there were only about 10 guys in the league who held the ball for less time this week. And in terms of how I scored the pressure, it was a very difficult game for Lamar to get any ample time space plays. Allen was also had some reasonable amount of pressure from the Ravens. Just the problem was that most of the pressure on Allen just flushed him out of the pocket and gave him extended time outside the pocket. Right. And that was obviously frustrating. All right. Well, run game delivered big plays. Lamar was outstanding under pressure. Big game for Zay Flowers. I think this is, you know, one of the takeaways that I hope is something that Ravens can really lean on this year, is there's nobody who can cover Zay Flowers on a crossing route. It doesn't appear.
Maybe I'll learn my lesson next year, Ken, but there is no correlation whatsoever between, this is 2 years in a row now, between what Zay does in training camp, what Zay does in the regular season, because his training camp performances are so quiet that I am convinced, and I shared this quote unquote bold prediction on the Banner Ravens podcast that I do with my co-host Paul Mancano, that like Rashad Bateman could, and in fact will, surpass Zay as wide receiver one, because I mean, you know, you saw it out there. There were practices out there at training camp where Rashad was catching or like either being targeted 8 times or catching 8 passes in a single practice. And that there were, you could probably kind of one hand the number of practices that Zay had where he's catching more than 3 or 4 balls. And it's not really explosive stuff. It's not downfield stuff. And then, as you said, you turn the tape and the eye test matches, the tape matches the eye test, which was that there was well and truly almost no one on that Bills secondary. And they have some, they have at least two pretty darn good cornerbacks who could cover him. So I guess I'll just kind of hand wave whatever he does or doesn't do next year in camp next year, because it really doesn't compute to whatever he does in the regular season, which last year was a Pro Bowl season, and this year might be even better.
Andrews has certainly been a player who is constantly targeted every camp. You know, he's one of Lamar's favorites from that standpoint, but he didn't, he got one target in this game. That was the only tight end target in the whole game in 84 snaps that they combined for. And it's interesting, you know, the 12 personnel comment is an interesting one, because I think that's probably combining 12 and 21 since the tight ends line up in the backfield a lot. So it's really, it's a combination of both. I'm not saying is incorrect at all. It's a very striking statistic, and it's worth considering. I wouldn't take it to be anything but the Ravens were successful running with two heavies as opposed to three lights, you know, which is the kind of the choice you make. You can either have 11 personnel with three wide receivers on the field, or you have some combination of a fullback and tight ends totaling two.
Sure.
You can run pony backfields. The only thing I can think of that doesn't fit into that category, 13.
And they did that once or twice.
They did. It was pretty cool to see. We hadn't, I don't remember seeing that in camp. Yeah, maybe they did. I can't really remember one way or the other. But anyway, it was nice that we did see it here in week one. You always get to open your Christmas presents and see something different.
Yeah, there's a plenty of cool. What was one of the ones cool concepts that I targeted? Maybe I'll get to it when we talk about it. Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things that we do hear a lot said is we're talking about Harbaugh's role in not managing the clock in this game. And I think there's certainly some validity to the not milking the play clock component, which, by the way, has got to be Harbaugh and Monken who've got to both be on that, and Lamar, for that matter, has got to be on the same page. But the team seemed to be, from the way they practiced the offseason, that like they should have been ready to produce on that level. I mean, it was all the set snap drills we saw at the beginning of practice, day after day after day after day, go to the line without your helmet, basically get the play called in the huddle, get to the line, go through your motion, get the snap off, get out of your stance quickly, and then there's no contact or anything after that. You're trying to show that you can run a play without flinching and hold your water for the time they're there. It's very intentional practice. They spent a lot of time on it to try and be able to run more complex cadences. And yet that should really, one way in which that really should help them is to drain a play clock when they feel like it. Get to line with 20 seconds left, drain a play clock. I didn't really like the excuse that if you let the play clock go too far, then you just give the other team a chance to tee off on you. Because I think you can go to 5 seconds. I don't think the defense can afford to tee off on you still.
Yeah, I think you're right that you should be able to execute whenever the play clock is. But there was a play that did stick out to me, and I wasn't aware of where the Ravens were in the play clock. But on the Oliver, disruption that leads to the Derrick Henry fumble. It looks like, you know, Roger Rosengarten is trying to scoop Oliver, who's the three tech, as they run to the left side of the line. And it's possible that, you know, you put the blame solely on Roger, but also you could look at that same play and say maybe he expected some help from Tyler Linderbaum, but Tyler has to, as opposed to taking a step toward Oliver, has to confront a blitzing linebacker, a run blitzing linebacker at the line of scrimmage. Again, this is like when the Bills know that the Ravens are having to
Turn
the clock off. And so, you know, again, if that was a situation where, and like if it's Matt Milano, if it's Terrell Bernard, those are two very smart, high functioning linebackers when they're locked in. You know, Matt Milano for a time was all pro worthy. Maybe he's back to that level already when he was healthy. But you could say, again, if you connect the dots between that and the fact that there was perhaps a decaying play clock that guy knew to trigger at that particular time, and that threw off the rhythm and the timing of the entire thing. And you get from point A to point D, and point D is Derrick Henry losing the fumble because no one can block at Oliver in time.
I think that one of the complaints about it was that the play clock was at 23 or something and was snapped.
I think that was, I obviously didn't watch the broadcast copy, but mm-hmm. I think someone said that was like a mistake on the actual broadcast view. Like it was actually closer to 5 or 10 seconds.
Okay. It's gone viral today, that element, but that's interesting to hear. That's good to hear. Cause that's the kind of thing that I would be very upset by. Phil Simms always brags about how he could do it with the Giants and run the play clock down to one every time and get it snapped at that point.
That's right.
Yeah. He has he's one of the few quarterbacks who takes no shame in the game manager tag. Yeah, so it's kind of fun to hear from that.
Why should you, if you're making tens of million dollars a year as a game manager?
There you go. Keaton Mitchell being deactivated, surprise at all?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I hadn't sat down and got my pencil out and did the inactives math, but you know, I think you like to reward guys for good training camps, good practices, good preseasons, and I thought Keaton had all those things, and to see him not get the nod on game day was surprising, disappointing, whatever. Obviously he's a huge fan. When we were forecasting how explosive this offense could be, he was like the third heat. If I could steal a 30 Rock joke, like he was the guy that last year's offense didn't have, because he was the ultimate change of pace back next to Derrick Henry and Justice Hill. I forget if this is something I brought up with you, Kent, but it's still baffling to me. And this kind of jibes with what Harbaugh was mentioning at his Monday presser when he was asked about Keaton. It's like, you know, when Keaton's in there, the defense knows that they are designer touches for him.
Terrible answer.
it's a terrible answer as a rationale, but also you look at what he did as a rookie, and he played let's say 240 snaps or something like that. Basically on half of those, he was either getting a target or a carry, which seems like an unbelievably high amount of usage for a second string, third string running back. So I don't think that Harbaugh comment is without any merit, even though it does, you know, kind of hand wave all the other stuff that Keaton brings to the table.
Let me give you the other side of that, because I think it's complete bull. First of all, Keaton Mitchell in his let's get this right, because we want to make sure that we're right for 2023, but he only had 47 carries in the season, so I know it wasn't, you know, 240 carries or anything that he had, but I want to get this right. That's looking at the preseason at 23. That's not what we want. Okay, so 135 total carries, and he ran the ball 48 times, it says here. I'm not sure, that might be an error by one, because I really thought it was 47, and I don't remember how many passes he had, but it was a handful, maybe
he
5 or 7.
So he got 47 carries and 11 targets.
So 11 targets. So 59 total out of 135.
And that matches up with 135 offensive snaps. So
okay,
I doubled all those, but still pretty close.
That's cool. Okay, so we're anyway, if it's 42% of the time he's getting a target, I say that's not bad. That's an opportunity to use that player as a misdirection component. If everybody says, oh my God, Keaton Mitchell's in the game, how's he going to get the ball? Well, use him in the backfield, use him as the flanker, use him wherever you want, and use him as a one-third misdirection play. There's a basic mathematical philosophy in poker that says you can reduce all of your willingness to bluff to about one third of the time because of that. And the Ravens, literally, they have a front door, a side door, and a back door that they can run the football through when they have Lamar Jackson, Derrick Henry, and somebody else who can run jet motion. And it gives them every single option they need to misdirect the defense very effectively. And Keaton Mitchell just amplifies that. I mean, it's like having Zay Flowers be in motion. It does it. You can run pony with that. There's so many things. And that's why I was just sure that Mitchell would be on the field a lot more this year, would force his way on as a misdirection component after the camp he had.
Yeah, it's possible. I do wonder if the Keaton Mitchell fear factor now is as pronounced in 2025 as it would have been, you know, at the end of 2023, considering mm-hmm. just how languid his play was at times last year. So maybe there is some, you know, let's be smart about this and like debut him. I mean, like, granted, he's not going to get any stronger or faster over the course of this, but let's roll him out when the time is right. Generally, I'm not a huge fan of like pony personnel more than a couple snaps a game at most. I just think it's one of those things that like you really have to have a receiving threat for it to be like a substantive additive element to your offense. Mm-hmm. With Derrick Henry as a lead blocker, it's always fun, and certainly that was like the threat I think on the Zay Flowers screen catch and run touchdown with Justice Hill, I believe, in motion, or maybe I'm getting those two flip-flopped. I think sooner or later we'll see Keaton out there. I just don't know how close he is to knocking that door down, considering, you know, just how frankly bad some of the Ravens special teams play was. And if he's not any better than the guys who are getting snaps right now, then that's a little bit alarming.
Well, some of that weakness is things he can't address. Some of it is stuff he can directly address. And one of the things they did is kind of put themselves at risk in the backfield, which I didn't think they do, by having Justice Hill return kicks.
Right.
I thought the natural thing would be you might have Tylan Wallace, you might have LaJonte Wester returning kicks as well, so that you would keep two running backs kind of in bubble wrap for only offensive play, which is obviously that's hardly bubble wrap. That's some heavy duty usage you're getting out of them there. And Mitchell, you know, I would have said was their best pure kickoff returner of the group. Ali had a return in the preseason, which was pretty good, but it's right up the middle, perfectly blocked play. I mean, he didn't do anything special. And in fact, he kind of tripped from just a little bit of contact from the kicker, which allowed others to catch up to him. It was, I don't want to totally I'll just say that return, but it wasn't a top flight return in terms of it being something really special. It was just a long return is what it basically was.
Yeah. And Keaton averaged over 30 yards a kickoff return last year. So there is it's a small body of evidence. I think only 5 returns total, but there is that body of evidence.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's keep going. A lot of talk obviously about John Harbaugh today. And I wanted to touch a little bit more on that in particular, since you've been at both of his press conferences, right? Both in Buffalo and then again in yesterday at the Castle, right?
Correct.
Okay. So what is the tenor of those questions being? So all I've done is read the transcripts. I haven't really sat down there. I know there was sort of a video of it from, I believe, the Buffalo one, but I don't know if there's video out there or not. It might be on the Ravens website, but I didn't take the time to look at it. I just read the transcripts to see what his answers looked like. They looked a little defensive, and I'm really trying to understand the tenor of the questions and the responses.
On Sunday, it was a little bit more defensive than it was on Monday. I think on Monday we were expecting what we got was like a more measured John Harbaugh. To kind of give you a sense of our expectations for it, our columnist at the Banner, Kyle Goon, was joking in our Ravens Slack about how he would have put good money that John Harbaugh would have shown up to the Monday presser with his reading glasses on, which is like the kind of emblem that he likes to strike when he, you know, is
seen down to serious professorial business. Yeah.
Yes. Scholarly. So it was surprising to see him walk out there without the readers on. But I thought he was, you know, nothing these coaches say after a result like that is going to be satisfactory to fans. But I thought for the most part, he didn't really elide any questions. I thought he answered them, at least the ones that I was interested in, pretty straightforwardly. You know, he was asked about his aggressiveness, and he said, you know, I want to, the most important thing to me is getting first downs, which, you know, some fans will, I'm sure, take issue with, like saying, well, why don't we get first downs by passing the ball in these late game scenarios, as opposed to running it when everyone knows we're going to run it, that kind of thing. You know, he talked about the win probability, because I asked, you know, they're like ESPN and the statistician Ben Baldwin both came out with their own like punt win probability versus their go for it win probability, both of which had the 4th-and-3 decision as being strongly go for it by like a margin of 6 to 8 percentage points. And John's said his was between 1 and 2%, which I found was interesting, because you would think that ostensibly they're working under the same body of evidence and everything, and that the models wouldn't be that drastically different, because 1 and 2% is a much, much bigger when we're talking about these kind of decisions than 6 to 8%. But, you know, he sat there and took about half an hour of questions, which is pretty long for him. And I don't really feel like that there was, again, I had basically 1 hour of sleep the night before, so my memory isn't all that great, but there weren't a whole lot of questions that either myself or others came away from being like, wow, like I can't believe he didn't put, you know, didn't give a direct answer, just lied through his teeth about this question or that question.
Well, that honestly, the 1 or 2% doesn't sound right to me at all. I understand that not everybody has the same kind of framework and whatnot they're working with. I'll just say the situation had significant redraw value to go for it. Now, part of that I'm working off of is that the Ravens are still going to have 3 timeouts. And in truth, it looks like the Ravens, had they gone for it, would have only had 2 timeouts, because they probably would have had to call one to get Lamar over the big hit from the previous play, to get a play out there to get to do that. They would have had to call it. And that would have reduced their chance to win the game, no doubt about it. But I still think that it was a pretty strong go for it option there. And I think that the Ravens probably would have liked to see the ball in Lamar's hand there at the end, run or pass, and given him options. Get out to one side of the field where basically you catch a defender in no man's land, and he has to decide to go after Lamar or go after the receiver, which, you know, a lot of boot plays just come down to that anyway, if you're going to try something like that.
Yeah, and it is interesting just to kind of trace John's fading fourth down aggressiveness over the years. Like, I wrote about it, you know, as part of our game coverage on from Sunday night, and mentioned it in a story that's going up tomorrow. Like, when that offense took the league by storm in 2019, he pressed the advantage by going forward on 4th-and-1 and 4th-and-2, and they were ridiculously effective. And he's fallen off that pace, while the Dan Campbells of the world have picked up the pace and probably exceeded him in terms of just the overall aggressiveness relative to, you know, time and game clock and all these different circumstances. But for everyone pointing to John Harbaugh not being like super aggressive or aggressive at all during these implosions, I would point them to 2 games in 2022. Again, 3 years ago at this point, so it doesn't really offer a whole lot of connective tissue. But in that collapse against the Dolphins, they did go for it on 4th-and-1 at Miami's 40 while they were up 35-21 in the fourth quarter. They did not get it, and then a couple of plays later, Tyreek Hill scores on a 48-yard touchdown catch. 2 weeks later, that was the collapse against Buffalo, where they were up 23 against Buffalo pretty late in the first half, and then they just get completely blanked in the second, and Buffalo slowly but surely works their way back into the game. And, you know, the Ravens.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Let's have the ball at Buffalo's 2 with about 4 minutes remaining, 4th-and-goal, and they decide to go for it rather than kicking the gimme field goal and taking their chances with that Bills offense. And Lamar throws the interception to, I think, Jordan Poyer at the back of the end zone. The Bills, you know, take over the 20, and they just have that death march to field goal range and basically put the game on ice with a gimme field goal. So it's just two examples. There was something that happened a year later where the Ravens punted on 4th and 2 from their own 33 against that, you know, really stingy Pittsburgh defense. But again, they were only up 2 points in that one. You didn't really feel that bad kicking to that Steelers offense, considering what your defense looked like and considering what that Steelers offense looked like. But again, I just, you know, felt it kind of necessary to raise that context to everyone who's saying that John Harbaugh has never been aggressive in similar circumstances.
You know, you're bringing up a couple of good examples, but I want to start by saying that I think the Ben Baldwin bot is a good league average kind of situation in terms of figuring out how you're going to do it. It's a great anchor point. Okay, great anchor point. And if Ben Baldwin bot is telling me I'm 6 or 8% ahead under those circumstances, I then want to look at the individual circumstances of this game. And the big one is that defense was not ready to go out on the field again in any way, shape, or form again. And there's been several times when this has been true. Christmas night, 2016, same exact situation. They just given up two drives, touchdown drives to the Steelers of 15 yards per play both times. One is 5 yards, one 5 plays and one 6 plays for 90. And they gave those both up, and then they scored too quickly, and they gave them a chance to come back from 3 down. And they not only got it a field goal range to tie it, they then won on the immaculate extension, as the Pittsburgh fans call it. This game was another case where there was just no way in hell were the Ravens ready to play defense in this. They hadn't had a drive over 4 plays in the second half. And people who listen to this show a lot have heard me say that it's not just how many total snaps you have to play defensively. And they were out-snapped 78-50 in the game, 50-22 in the second half. And the problem is how many consecutive snaps you have to go out there and play. And they were asking players like Travis Jones and Matt Abike to go out there snap after snap and not replacing them a lot of that time. And it's an incredibly difficult task to get reasonable stops on that. So frustrating as hell. And I think if Ben Baldwin bot is saying it's 6 or 8%, I'm going to say it's even more overwhelming. The choice should be to go for it. I did have a question asked about this. So one of the listeners said, and I want to get this question right. He asked if, would it have been better, even if Lamar couldn't go, to use a Derrick Henry direct snap as your 4th and 3 play from that spot. And you'd be going for it a couple different ways there. You'd hopefully Derrick Henry or Derrick Henry as a passer gets that, or with some sort of, you know, weird pitch or lateral or whatever, is able to get the first down. Or possibility number two is that you commit to giving the ball away on your own side of the 50 and making a stop on 3 downs with the timeouts you have to get a redraw opportunity with hopefully Lamar back at quarterback.
Yeah, I don't know how good one of the caveats in all this. And this could just be like relative to, this just could be a function of like where the chip in the ball was or, you know, where, how the data got inputted into these various models. But I think the Brian Burke ESPN modeling that was tweeted out last night, and he, by the way, I guess he grew up in Baltimore and Annapolis. Yes. And is a Ravens fan. Yeah. Have you had him on the podcast?
I have not, I've interacted with him a number of times.
Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. They're like the model that he used was citing 4th and 2. I think the Ben Baldwin tweet was also using 4th and 2, even though it was officially charted as 4th and 3. So that would have accounted for some of the differences, mm-hmm. perhaps if Harbaugh was going off 4th and 3. Again, I don't know how much this, and to be clear, I also would have been in favor of going 4th and 3. I just want to get that on the record. But yeah, it's
all right. Well, let's move on. Honestly, it is something that there's only so much you can do. The end of the first half, honestly, the total, it's not a hill of beans even to talk about the extra play that was run with 2:03 to go. I just don't think you can map out all the circumstances very easily. My own preference would have been to let the clock run down to 2 minutes there and you know, take your chances with running first down there. But it's an unfortunate set of downs after that led to exactly the 1 second being remaining for Buffalo to kick that field goal. And nothing that John did honestly change the percentage of the Ravens winning anything like Henry's fumble did, for example. So we're not, you know, I don't want to defend Harbaugh nor attack him either way for what happened. The mistakes were made, but the even the fourth and three chance is not, it's not in the, even in the same league with having a Henry fumble in there. So
yeah, and I think that actually I was, you know, this was kind of was talking to you about pre-show, Ken, like the story that I have coming out Wednesday for the banner, just looking at the grand scope of all these collapses, the kind of prism through I looked at it was basically these, the eight games that Ben Solak tweeted about where they at one point had a 90% win probability, mm-hmm. only to lose it. And so I just like looked at the basically the game flow of all of these games. And first of all, just some hilariously bad execution on both sides of the ball. So basically what I did was like looked at what happened after the game got to a point where it was under 90% win probability, which, you know, in some cases was like the final 8 minutes of the fourth quarter, final 4 minutes of the fourth quarter. In the Bills game, it was basically like mm-hmm. all the second half because of how early that game was a seeming blowout. So it added up on offense to 22 possessions, 90 plays for 358 yards, 4 yards per play. 11
four points. Plays per drive. Ugh.
No, 4 yards per play. Oh, okay, but wait, yeah,
you said 90 plays on
yeah,
on
yeah. So, 22 yeah,
you're drives. Doing, you're, yeah,
I discredited your beautiful mind. Yeah, so 90 plays over 22 possessions for yep. 358 yards, which is 4 yards per play,
yep.
and 11 points, so 0.5 points per possession.
It's not with gonna nine do it.
Turnovers, and then on defense, which I judged to be even worse than the offense, if you can believe that, 23 possessions, 171 plays for 1,166 yards, which is only 6.8 yards per play. And I say only because it would be a lot more if I'd thrown out, you know, some of the kneel downs and some of the actual clock killing drives after the game was basically wrapped up and, you know, that the other team was just putting a game on ice, and 114 points. So 5 points per possession
versus 0.5. So they scored 10 times as much, and we would expect them to score more because the trailing team is going to score. Sorry, the leading team is going to score less trying to run out the game, but right. not like that. So,
but all of which is to say that, like, as bad as the offensive execution and defensive execution has been, my take, and maybe this is, you know, just invalidated by the sheer ugliness of the stats that I just gave to you, was just how terribly unlucky they have been in some of these games. I don't want to give away the whole story, but obviously I'm sure you're smart enough and your listeners are smart enough to know about like fumble luck and fumble recovery rates. And basically yeah. if you play enough games and fumble enough times, the expectation is that you will settle around close to 50% of fumbles recovered on both sides of the ball.
I also don't think you need to like explain this further when it's 9 turnovers and 22 drives. That's an absurd rate.
Yes,
I know, but it requires no explanation.
This is like a perhaps even more galling statistic.
Yeah.
So in those 8 games, again, after like at the sub 90% win probability rate, the yeah. Ravens have on offense fumbled 7 times. Excuse me, they have fumbled 5 times. They have also forced 3 fumbles on defense. So 8 total fumbles.
And how many did they recover?
Do you want to guess how many they recovered?
0.
0. And okay. All 5 of the fumbles that they lost were in Ravens territory. So, and that's not even including like the pick six that Lamar threw against Cleveland that was off a lineman's yeah. hand, or the interception that he threw against Buffalo in the 22 game that was off a lineman's hand, or the incredibly ridiculous Keon Coleman touchdown that again goes off of Dawson Knox's right hand and, you know, is like, almost like volleyball set to him in the back of the end zone. So I'm, you know, not the biggest John Harbaugh defender. I think I'm probably more of an advocate for him than the current Joe fan in Baltimore after this game. But I will say that, like, some of the, when you look at just the 20,000 foot view of just how bloody unfortunate they've been in some of these cases happening at the exactly wrong time. I mean, the only time, like the only game last year that Derrick Henry lost a fumble was the Steelers game. And now he not only picks a terribly bad game to to fumble again and lose a fumble, but it's a terrible time and it's a terrible spot in the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was definitely truly awful. And, you know, having one turnover shouldn't doom you from winning a game. The average turnovers per game is around 1.2. So it should be a case where the one turnover was a pretty good result for the offense, frankly. And they're playing a tough team. Maybe you wouldn't think so, but they're also a little bit better, I think, than that other team, you know, in terms of what they could do offensively, and how the Buffalo fans were reacting in the stadium was remarkable. Game's a lot like the 2003 game against the Seahawks, which I know is a little bit before your time, but you may have heard of it or thought of it. Or had it mentioned to you before. Ravens won that game 44-41 in overtime, came back from 17 down in the fourth quarter. Half the stadium is gone in Baltimore. Half the stadium is gone in Buffalo. You were there. You saw it. We had a tipped ball playing a huge part. In that case, it was Marcus Robinson tipping a ball to Frank Sanders for a 44-yard completion on 4th and 28. In this game, it was the touchdown, of course. You know, they had a huge fumble in each game, the Henry fumble, and Max Strong had ball basically taken away by the human claw machine that is Ray Lewis. Just latched onto it and took it away from him. It's so much in common between those two games. And, you know, I look at it in that sense, there's a timing snafu in both games, the end of the first half, and then the clock was stopped improperly in the game in 2003. There's so many similarities. And when I at least go through that, there's a slight catharsis I can go through and say, we've won games like this, or we've won a game like this, maybe would be the more accurate way to put it. And I don't, I don't feel as bad, but the whole thing about losing eight fumbles, because even if it should be four that you recover out of those eight, and I'm not sure what the percentage of own and op fumbles recovered rate ought to be, but you're probably going to come out, since it's 5-3, very close to four, you should recover out of those eight, I'm going to guess. Then you'd be talking about five turnovers and 22 drives still, which is way too many.
Right.
But ineptitude of play. Sounds like a great article, by the way, Jonas. I'll try and make sure I get a chance to read that.
Thanks.
I want to talk methodology for me, but I'm going to do it off air because one of the things is, how do you judge? Did you just judge the point at which the game became 90% in each case? Because effectively, every single one of the Ravens' wins plus some of their losses has reached a 90% point at some point. And you can tell that if you've got a good source of that for some period.
This one was inexact. So for the offense, like in every case with the offense, the win probability was under 90% after the other team had scored. So that made the stop and start parameters easier to find. Like you just match, you know, ESPN, their game cast tab on their game results thing. You can eyeball it and you can move your cursor over to see where the odds change. With defenses, it was inexact because obviously your win probability decreases after the opponent scores. So in those cases, I included not just the plays after it went up below 90%, but also just basically the drive in totality, just to account for like, all right, this is kind of where this is where stuff started to go haywire, just okay. Because I thought it was spiritually the right thing to do.
All right. We'll talk methodology more later. I don't want to drag this out any further.
Yep.
Obviously, Buffalo scored 5 of 7 times in the red zone. The Ravens didn't even get into the red zone that much. 3 times in a game where they scored, you know, 5 touchdowns, and they went 1 for 3 only from there because they had 4 touchdowns from outside the red zone. 30, 23, 29, 46 yards. Lightning strike offense. I'm not saying turn that off, but I guess I'm saying this is a game where it actually probably hurt the Ravens to be so explosive. It hurt the Ravens on defense to be so explosive, and it probably hurt them in terms of getting the game over with.
Yeah, and you put it together. So they were, what, 2 for... They were 1 for 3. So they are now, in their past 2 games against Buffalo, just 3 for 6 in the red zone, which, you know, you just give them one more touchdown or
and they win both games, right?
Yeah, well, they definitely win both games, but that is that's just how fine the margin, how thin these razor thin margins are.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Just giving them 7 more points, you spread it out how you like, right? Yeah. Great points per drive start for the Ravens against a defense that obviously had some holes in it. in terms of this, but I still think there's lots that we can draw about this that is positive. But I do think I want to go back to the intentionality of practice. I think the Ravens are going to go back and they're going to have to pick out the things that are not working about this offense and get them fixed pretty quickly. And so I think I pointed a couple, but I'd love to hear your thoughts. Max Protect, I think they're going to have to bring back some of that, potentially to protect Rosengarten. Now he had a very bad pressure game from my point of view. He had a really bad penetration game from my point of view. And you mentioned one play where you maybe thought the scheme might have not been for him to entirely have the stop Ed Oliver on the Henry fumble.
Right.
But he got a lot of protection last year and he didn't get much protection in this game, only three right side set or chip blocks. So they left him out on an island a lot there. And it was against some of their best pass rushers because Rousseau and Bosa and Ed Oliver were the three who were beating him over there.
Yeah, I think the Rosengarten false start to me looked like, again, maybe you have your own terminology, Ken, but I think what I saw Nate Tice use online on Twitter was like cheetah cadence, which is like, we're going to hurry to the ball and we're going to do a quick snap. And the Ravens hurried to the ball on that third and three that led to the false start. I don't know if they were going to quick snap it like they did on the play that led to the big Zay crosser where they have the Bills safety blitzing from like an 18 yard depth. But it looked like he got a little, out over his skis. Roger Rosengarten did on that one, maybe because of just how quick it was, which is like, it's not fine, but it's part of the risks that you take on, because I do think that cheetah cadence or whatever you want to call it, when they went quick, did a lot more good than harm overall.
Yeah. And that, by the way, that's a general thing of being very measured in terms of your cadence and what they really try to do this summer. I'm a big fan of it. I think it will provide value for the Ravens. I just don't, it will come with more total false starts by its nature. If you don't go on one every time, as Monk and Old didn't say it directly, you're gonna risk more false starts. But you also should pick up some defensive penalties. You should pick up some defensive slowness in terms of their ability to get out of the blocks. And you should also pick up some things from the defense in terms of them moving around pre-snap that you might be able to take advantage of in terms of how Lamar looks at it and moves around to a different play. And there was some of that in this game. He definitely was able to check into different plays.
Yeah, and I guess we'll have a better sense of just where the offense stands with that operational stability, that operational fluidity with a home game, without all the however many thousands, tens of thousands of well-lubricated Bills fans at Highmark Stadium making as much noise as they can. This is going to be a smart home crowd in Baltimore. Obviously, Miles Garrett is a scary enough presence that he could probably just get you to react sooner than you should, because he is just that imposing of a physical presence. And the mere idea of him blazing across the line is enough to get you to jump early. But for the most part, this does sound like a more controlled environment for us to evaluate whether that operational ability is in fact, up to snuff.
Right. I mean, I didn't think it played out poorly in this game. They certainly moved the ball fairly much at will for the bulk of the game. All right, let's jump into some of Lamar's performance here, because we're getting way behind, as we always do when we talk football, Jonas, because I love talking football with you. You've seen a lot of different things about the number of rushers that are out there online, and they'll call things a blitz or not. I just want to tell you what I saw. The Buffalo rushed 4-12 times, 7.8 yards per play Lamar had against that. They rushed 5-4 times, 17.5 yards per play on the four plays against that. They rushed 6-5 times, 31 yards, 5.2 yards per play. They did have one of their sacks with both 4 and 6. They didn't rush any other number. They didn't rush 7 at all, even though they had some big looking numbers at the line of scrimmage. One time they had 8 at the line and they dropped out 4 and 4, four simulated pressure drops from that, which I think you're really putting yourself at a disadvantage versus Lamar Jackson when you do that. But I don't actually remember what the result of that play was. 4.67 pass rushers per play is high. And probably the more bothering thing about this is just how poor the opportunity set for Lamar Jackson was in this game. Only 3 ample time space opportunities. 9 times the ball was out quickly and 9 times he was under pressure. That 3-to-1 relationship between pressure and ATS is totally unacceptable. That's got to be improved. for next week. And I know, you know, you're talking about having the X best pass blocking win rate. I didn't see it that way. You know, and I do have a 3 second standard. I'm holding the lineman to in terms of keeping, mm-hmm. keeping players out of the cone. And also that the cone, as I define it, is critical for being able to step into that. So you right. don't have to be all the way to the quarterback or have a hand in his face or whatever. You just have to be threatening the quarterback's legs and he's not going to throw normally. And that usually is a big portion of the benefit you get from a pressure.
Yeah. Talking about pressure, and the Bills blitz rates, I think it was probably expected because if you look at what they did well in that playoff game, it was man blitzes. And I think mm-hmm. Lamar really showed up and showed them like what you're kind of messing with when you mess with a bull that way. You know, in the divisional round game, he was 3 for 7 against man blitzes for 22 yards. He threw an interception. He took the sack that led to the strip sack by Von Miller. And he was pressured 4 times overall, according to Sports Info Solutions. I don't have the date in front of me for what he did against man blitzes in this game, but I think it was like close to, you know, 80 yards, 100 yards, and just generally did a much better job of actually punishing Buffalo when they did, you know, leave those guys out on an island, which is, you know, something, I forget if you were there, Ken, but like the day that I asked Todd Monken about that, he was, you know, an open book. He was like, this is something that we should absolutely be better at because we have Lamar, because right. we have these great route runners, because we have good enough protection. So, you know, I know that's something that Warren Sharp has, you know, gotten Ravens fans really riled up about this offseason. Just like, why isn't this team any good against man blitzes? And for at least 1 week, it seems like they're off to a good start.
Well, good day for Zay from that perspective. I'm forgetting if there was a blitz on the 29 yard pass to, touchdown pass to Hopkins. Yeah, that was a 5-0. So that was a blitz. And they had even had double coverage on Hopkins on the play and still got it in there. I don't know if you call that really a man blitz anymore, but sure. But he had the safety help that he hoped for. When they rush five plus, and you're going to see different numbers on this because some people define it differently in terms of who counts as a pass rusher. But 9 for 101. So 11.2 yards per play. With you know, 5+ coming, so Lamar made him pay, and that included in that group a sack. So you know, it's not like it was all you know, perfect going there. Lamar did run them out of the one big pressure, which I thought was just another highlight reel play for his entire career. The what should have been probably a 15 or 20 yard sack. It looked like it was going to be with Bosa and whoever chasing him down. Bosa and Epinesa, Bosa and Rousseau, whoever it was. It was that was remarkable. That I've never seen a fan base so upset as they were by that play. Like I was there for when Lamar Jackson had the big run at Cincinnati, the Houdini run, and the Cincinnati fans were, wow, that was pretty cool. And this game, it's like, this is a joke. I'm leaving, kind of thing, literally on that play. So
this is a very random tangent, Ken, but do you follow or are you familiar with soccer at all?
Not really. You follow okay. Premier League or something?
Do you know who Ray Hudson is, the broadcaster?
No, but that's okay.
He's an English former pro who has like some degree of fame, certainly more fame overseas for a very poetic, like freestyling, freewheeling, poetic license for some of his calls. He's an analyst, not a play-by-play guy, and you know, like his big. I think the word that he's probably most associated with is magisterial, which he has used to describe, you know, countless Lionel Messi goals and other, you know, incredible plays by the best players in the world. And just he announced his retirement. I mentioned him because he announced his retirement today after a long career in broadcasting. He's 70 years old. And just thinking about like how much fun it would be to hear a guy with those beautiful English pipes and just the incredible vocab that he has. Like he has a vernacular all his own to describe a sequence as incredible as Lamar scrambling for 20 yards after nearly backpedaling into a 15 to 20 yard sack, followed by Derrick Henry just running wild for that, 50 yard touchdown or whatever it was. Just like, I would these are two of my interests that I would like to see converge in one magisterial way. If I could borrow a Ray Hudsonism.
It's very cool. One of the things I've been in the UK a number of times, and one of the things that I read over there is I like to read cricket writing because it's different from any kind of sports writing, any other kind of sports writing. It's in this flowing language that is, you know, it was an inning of such power and tenacity. And yes. I mean, the thing lasts for an hour and a half, you know, the guy's slowly walking back to defend his wickets and whatnot. But
my favorite, like, these guys are so far up their own assholes, like the English shock thing is, you know, like you get to these penalty kicks at the end of, you know, World Cup quarterfinal, World Cup semifinal. And I think the announcers feel compelled to describe the kicks with language that is as elevated as the stakes themselves. And so they will describe these, you know, rudimentary, like 12-yard kicks with these flowing adjectives or just these overpowering adjectives, like beautiful or perfect or unstoppable. It's like, no, he just picked the direction that the goalie didn't go. That's all it was. Like, very rarely does it rise to the level of the sublime or the transcendent.
All right. Outstanding. Let's talk a little bit. Well, we've got a little bit more about Jackson maybe here. He made two out of two contested throws in this game. One of them was to Hopkins, another just a little 5-yard pass to Bateman. But the Hopkins throw was a thing of beauty. It was thrown in there. Well, great catch. Don't want to put that down in any way, but it was really dropped in just the right bucket too for Hopkins to make that play.
Yeah, and I guess we can just talk about him as opposed to, because there's not a whole lot of other stuff to talk about him if we get to the other guys later. But that was a play that looked like vintage Hopkins. Like, he is against Christian Benford at the line of scrimmage. It looks like his press coverage, and just he stacks him slowly but surely. Like, he beats him just enough with his release, then he wins enough with his hand fighting. And he, you know, gets him with another slight shove, and finally he's got him fully stacked, and he's got him, you know, he's looking, Benford's just all he can see at that point when the ball is delivered is the back of Hopkins' jersey, and yep. Like, that is vintage DeAndre Hopkins. I don't know if you saw it, Ken. I don't know how many of our listeners watched it either, but there was like a very strange interview with Christian Benford after the game where a Bills reporter asked him about the DeAndre Hopkins play, because it was such an unbelievable highlight, and Benford was just not having any of it. Like, he was very, very aloof and kind of cold toward all the Bills media as they were asking him not only about that but about the defense and the game itself. Obviously, I'm sure there probably weren't a whole lot of Bills defenders who were proud of that game, but it was very, very strange to see a guy who, we should say, is, I believe, from Randallstown or Owings Mills, and maybe that added to the saltiness of his interview. But it was very, very strange to see a guy like that kind of aloof after a game that incredible.
Yeah, it really is. It's a great stack job, and you've described it very well. But a lot of people hear that term and not necessarily know what it means. But when the receiver stacks the corner, he basically gets in front of him so that the trailing coverage from the corner has to make a decision between giving up optimal position or trying to make effectively a lane change to reestablish optimal position. And that usually requires tremendous makeup speed to do. So a Christian Benford, who has good, but not tremendous speed for a corner, even against a receiver like DeAndre Hopkins, who has pretty average speed at this point in his life, is probably not going to be able to do that. And then the way the ball was thrown, it wasn't going to happen anyway. Even if he'd reestablished that inside position with the leverage he'd wanted, he wouldn't have been able to get it. But think about how frustrated you get when you're driving behind somebody who doesn't want to pick a lane on a two-lane road. That's perfect. Stack receiver is, yeah.
My only other note from watching D-Hop, again, not a whole lot to write home about, but there was a third and five play where he just kind of caught my eye for how explosively he came off the ball. Like, I think either Zay or Bateman was, you know, the outside receiver, and he was in the slot, which was interesting to see just how often he was the inside receiver and not the prototypical X that maybe we had all envisioned him being when the Ravens signed him. And to see his get off compared to the wide receiver who was the outside receiver was jarring and I think encouraging.
Yeah. All right. We talked about some of these things. 11 sets, 4 chips, a pretty significant, but not enormous, pretty average, I guess I would say, commitment of eligible receivers to blocking. The Ravens actually, since they only had 4 chip blocks and most of theirs were set, it's a little bit more of a commitment than you would normally see. A chip block, when you do go out into the pattern, there's a limited number of patterns you can run after you throw a block on an edge defender. But if you're set block, you're committing to not go out into the pattern. So they did commit some of their eligible receivers in this game to giving Jackson a little more time, and it didn't really pay off for them, or at least it's hard to see where the payoff was, given that he still didn't have a lot of extended plays in the game. Not like, you know, it was 2.7 seconds in time to throw.
Yeah, and I wasn't keeping an eye on this closely, but just, you know, every once in a while you would see Andrews throwing his weight around as a chip blocker. So maybe that contributed to just the overall low target share, because obviously you're not really going to throw a lot of passes to Mitchell Payton's way. And obviously Kohler is more of the inline replacement, the Pat Ricard replacement.
Two sets and one chip for Andrews. I don't think that's a legitimate problem with the thing, but there's a three passing plays where he was running a restricted set of routes. That's a, right. You know, a valid point. Don't need to talk about anything. I don't think we need to talk about any of the rest of this. Let's break it here, and we'll come back. We'll talk about the offensive line in part two. But Jonas, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate having you. Tell folks where they can contact you and talk football with you online.
Yeah, you can reach me. My email, jonas.schaefer@thebanner.com. You can also just read our coverage at thebanner.com. We've dropped Baltimore because we are moving into the DC suburbs. So you can find us by Googling for either one, but just for housekeeping purposes, it is thebanner.com. And obviously on Twitter/X, it is Jonas_Schaefer. That's JonasSchaefer.
All right. Outstanding. Thanks so much for coming on, Jonas. Other folks out there, if you're looking to do a film study short, and in particular, a John Harbaugh one, I probably will do that over the bye week. If you want to be on a panel of that, that would be great. I'd love to hear from you for that. Otherwise, thanks for all you do to support the show, and we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.